A prisoner is on the run tonight after he and three others used a forklift to break out of a Murdoch prison before going on a crime spree through our southern suburbs.
The other fugitives, Quinton John Slater and Stephen Baxter, were later caught in River Vale.
Police are still searching for Jeffrey Ninyet. He's been on the run for almost 24 hours since he escaped.
Nine of those prisoners are still on the run. Three have been recaptured overnight.
Anyone who comes in contact with 19-year-old Mr. Ninyet shouldn't approach him, but contact police.
Now, obviously, Sarah, if we knew they were going to do this, they wouldn't have been minimum security.
Confirmation as to who these prisoners are or just how dangerous. There have been reports in recent months.
And Port Augusta Prison is tonight in lockdown following a serious incident. The jail houses some of the state's most notorious criminals, including family killer Bevan Spencer Von Arnhem.
Two persons have escaped from the Capricorn Correctional Centre. These two persons are obviously still outstanding. Police are currently asking for any public assistance.
For over 200 years, people have been trying to escape from jails in this place we now call Australia. And if you thought jailbreaks were out of style, you might be interested to know that in July of 2018, two prisoners in Bathurst were busted trying to dig out of their cell with spoons. And they were covering up their handiwork with toothpaste. How retro.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Susanna Lopez is one of Australia's most prolific true crime authors. With her co-author James Morton, she's written around a dozen books about some of our worst behaved citizens. And she's back on our podcast to talk about their new book, The Great Escapes. Emily started by asking Susanna what attracted them to this particular topic.
Well, this was one of my favourites to write, actually, because there's something in all of us that kind of is rooting for, barracking for the escaper, particularly if they don't kill anybody on the way out.
Absolutely.
Because we think they've already been punished once by being sent to jail, but they've given the finger up to authority and they escape from that. Now, it has to be said that it's much easier getting out of jail than it is staying out of jail. But when the colony started, what the people in England thought was that this is just one great big natural jail, that Australia was something they could never get back to England from, that Australia had a vast natural jail with hostile environment, no food that they were familiar with, a really harsh environment. And it's true that, you know, from the First Fleet and the early convicts, if they tried to get away, they often came limping back to the settlements saying, please feed us, and, you know, got a few lashes and that was the end of it. But, of course, I've always said that Australia has been particularly prone to gang crime because in the beginning we had two gangs, the jailers and the jailed, and sometimes the jailers were as bad as the jailed. You know, some of those guards were pretty horrible people. The prison governors in the early days were also, you know, cruel or corrupt or both. And so as people tried to escape and then came limping back to the settlement, then they started getting harsher and harsher penalties. Now, you wouldn't believe it, Emily, the first guy that ever escaped from the colony was a guy called Black Caesar. It's thought he was from Madagascar, and he was kind of a First Fleet and had got seven years time in Australia, transportation, but he stole again and then he got life. This is 1788, 1790s. He bolted into the bush with a stolen gun and then he was put in chains at Garden Island. In other words, escape was hard. So he was put in chains and he bolted off again, stealing a canoe and a gun. In those days, they always called it bolting. Yeah. In fact, I suggested as a name for the book that we could still call it Bolters because it has that Australian cheekiness, you know, about getting out. So this time, with his stolen canoe and his gun, he returned to camp again and then he was sent to Norfolk Island. And I'll tell you a bit more about Norfolk Island. It was one of the most horrible places. 1795, he was sent to Port Jackson and he bolted again. So he kept trying to get out. Yeah. So, you know, that was a really interesting sort of start for them to learn. Bolt, come back. Bolt, come back. Yeah.
I guess they, the landscape was so, they didn't know how to navigate the landscape and the weather and, you know, all that. I mean, it just seems so bleak.
Well, there was a bunch of Irish convicts. I think that was 1791, where, again, just after the First Fleet, there were 20, a bunch of Irish convicts, 20, and I think there was a pregnant woman, and they all thought, this is from Botany Bay, they all thought that if they could just get up far enough, it couldn't be far to China, where they thought that people would welcome them and befriend them. So they thought if they could just get over a river or... Anyway, one died of exhaustion, four were speared, and the rest stumbled back to the colony half-starved. It was what the English wanted. It was a natural hostile jail from which really escape was almost impossible.
Obviously, we all know our history is so complicated because of, you know, the first Australians, and then we've got the First Fleet coming over and the convicts, and Australia's basically a jail. How, I guess... That you've mentioned that there's actually a story about an escapee and an Aboriginal man actually saved him.
This is someone we all think we know about, Buckley, and in 1803, so it was 20 or so years after they'd all been here, he escaped across the land, went down to the Bellarine Peninsula, I'm pointing because we're on the west side of Melbourne, and the Wathaurong Aborigines saved him. They actually believed he was the reincarnation of their dead chief. And he was given a wife and he lived with them from 1803 till 1835 when he gave himself up to authorities. At that stage, 1835, things had changed dramatically in the colonies and he couldn't even remember English. Wow. So he was recognised by his tattoos. He was pardoned. And he'd gained some skills. And so he was employed as a tracker. That's where the expression Buckley's chance comes from, like it was such a rare event. But, I mean, I don't know. Wouldn't that make a great movie? You know, I think that'd be a fantastic movie.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think whenever I think of the First Fleet jails and I don't know if that's what you even call it, I guess the jails in the colonies, I mean, they seem so brutal. What were the conditions like? If you were in jail... What was life like for you?
Well, first of all, you had to build your own jail.
Oh, God.
So, you know, they started off with fort-like settlements and not inescapable. You know, they weren't inescapable to begin with for the first few years. Down in Tasmania, they chose a pretty horrible place called Sarah Island, which is down near Macquarie Harbour. And again, it was considered safe because they couldn't get off the island. Yeah. It was surrounded by, you know, sharks and, you know, there were dogs, hungry dogs chained up across the isthmus so that it was really hard for people to get out. But there was a guy, in fact, there were seven or eight guys who got away in 1822 in the middle of winter, and he got away with seven others, and they lived, this is a Tasmanian winter, so you can imagine how horrible it was. So they got out of the fortress or whatever it was, and they got onto the mainland, and he'd lived on berries and eucalyptus shoots and boiled tea tree, but making very little progress through the Tasmanian bush. And you picture these guys, you know, lined up trying to make their way through the bush with machetes or whatever. Well, what started happening is that first one was killed and eaten, and then there were six. And then a few days later, then there was five. Mm. And then there was four. And at first they drew lots to see who was going to get killed and eaten, and then it was just the weakest person. One by one they all died and were killed. And after 103 days, Alexander Pierce, was found and went back to prison, went back to the fort. But in 1823, the next year, again, he tried another bolt attempt, this time on the shore, sort of against the shore. And he went with a young convict this time. But again, he killed and ate part of this young guy's body. and he eventually gave himself up and was hanged in 1824. So he Pierce the Cannibal, you know, everybody knows about him. But again, you think winter in Tasmania, thick bush.
Yeah, yeah.
And trying to get away from this island, which was kind of an island prison. They did fairly soon move to island prisons after they realised that quite a lot of people were bolting, and in Buckley's case, you know, that was in, you know, the early 1800s, they moved colonial jails to the prisons. So you've probably heard, Emily, of Norfolk Island, yes. Macquarie Harbour in Sarah Island in Tasmania. St Helena Island was a little bit later. That was in Moreton Bay. And they were just awful. They were described by visitors or clergymen that were coming as places of tyranny. They also, the authorities, the cruel and horrible prison governors, had become accustomed to people trying to bolt. And so they made the penalty for bolting much more serious after there'd been so many land escapes. So you either got hanging or you got 500 lashes. Mm. Now, that'd just about kill you.
Yeah, it would, yeah.
And the rest of your sentence, you got in double chains. So they really made it hard, but still people tried, and still on occasion people succeeded. So on the islands, they weren't kind of our romantic picture of, you know, a sunny tropical island with a beautiful sandy beach where the convicts can fish and surf and paddle in the sand. They were usually surrounded by muddy swamps and killer mosquitoes, and it was the hungry sharks around the islands that really did the guarding for the jails. At one stage, there was a priest who visited Norfolk Island, which was considered one of the most harsh and cruel. And you remember I talked about Black Caesar. He had a stint on Norfolk Island, and it was renowned for its cruelty. And at one stage, there was a conspiracy, 1834. There was a conspiracy to overthrow the troops that were guarding them, and 31 men were condemned to death. Now, there was going to be a reprieve of some of them. In other words, they would be allowed to live. So a priest came to the island to announce who would be allowed to live and be reprieved and who was going to hang out of the original 31. And the ones that were not to be hanged, the ones that were going to be reprieved to live longer on Norfolk Island, the priest said they fell down on their knees and they wept bitterly.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. So death was preferable to... Oh, my gosh. Because now, I mean, Norfolk Island's a bit of a holiday spot, although it does have quite a complicated history. I've got an auntie who was born on Lord Howe Island, so I haven't been to Norfolk, but Lord Howe Island, I mean, it's beautiful. It's a World Heritage Island, but I think Norfolk Island's a lot different to that. We've got this, I guess, when I was living in the UK, I lived in the UK for a long time, and people would go, oh, you're just a bunch of criminals in Australia, that's right, which I guess the white Australian history is that people came over because they'd, you know, done the wrong thing or were locked up for various things. But how do you think that has sort of built into our psyche? Like, you know, in terms of, you said that we, you know, love a good jail escape. How do you think that's?
I think we've got issues with authority. I mean, speaking incredibly generally, you know, we've got issues with authority. I think that there is a fascination with escape because, as I said earlier, it's a kind of a double finger up to the authority figures. You know, first of all, you've done a crime, then you'll be punished for it, and then you've set up, I'm getting out of here. Yeah. So there is that kind of little thrill we get when we think, especially if someone's escaped with ingenuity and when you look further into Australia's history, you know, back in the 1970s, and I know we'll talk about this later, but quite often the escapers are the armed robbers.
Yeah.
So to be an armed robber, and I presume armed robbers was kind of what bushrangers were, you had to have nerves of steel. To go into a bank or to go into, you had to have nerves of steel, especially when there were police around. And I think the same kind of quality, the nous, the ingenuity, the tools they used to escape. There was one fellow in, he was on St. Helena's Island, and there were 50 escape attempts in 60 years. This guy, Frederick Hamilton, in 1914, so we're, you know, another sort of 60 years forward, he made many attempts to get off the island. He tried a galvanized bathtub, which, you know, you have to imagine that's a pretty heavy thing,
yeah.
But he tried to get out a bit, and then when that sank, he came crawling back through the swamps and the mangroves to get back onto the island, and then he had some punishment. And then he tried a table, or that might have been with the galvanized iron bath. He tried that because he had to get several kilometers away to get to the mainland,
yeah.
And it was full of sharks.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of guys who tried to escape from St. Helena, and they ended up staying up to their necks in the mangrove swamps, being tortured by mosquitoes for like quite some days.
Mm.
And in the end, they were glad to go back.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was the ingenuity and the guts and the balls of steel that I think escapees needed to actually thwart authority the way they attempted to do. And this guy, Hamilton, Frederick Hamilton, when he was asked, I think he made it finally with a sort of a raft made out of planks from the building, one of the buildings, and he was asked by the magistrate, you know, why did you keep trying? Why did you do it? Why are you trying to escape all the time? And he says, if you leave the cage door open, the bird will fly away.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm only human.
Yeah.
It's my instinct to escape. It's my kind of duty to try and escape. That's how a lot of the guys felt about it.
Yeah. So some of them have planned this meticulously. They're trying their best. But were there any escapes, I guess, that were just a series of lucky circumstances that led them to just be able to,
yeah,
you know,
there was, I mean, among the people who we all know in our cultural folklore, like Darcy Dugan and people like that, sometimes they were lucky, more often they weren't. I mean, one guy, they built Pentridge Prison in Victoria in around the start of the 1850s, and at the beginning, they had to build, the prisoners had to build the prison. So they were sort of building fortresses and, you know, an adjacent building for the governor, and it was kind of in half-completed state. And so sometimes 20 or 30 blokes would literally just rush at the guards and make off,
yeah.
You know. So when it was in its half-completed state, because these prisons, like Pentridge as we recall it, you know, bluestone, high walls, yeah. And all that, they didn't just pop into existence. They had to be made,
yeah.
And they were made by convicts or prisoners.
Yeah.
So obviously in those days it was a little bit easy. They were lucky that the governor and his men were turned the other way, and there was a field they were planting with food that would supply the jail. And so out they went. There was one guy, one of my favourites from Pentridge, a guy called Edward Ryder. It's got to be the easiest escape in the world. He was working at the governor's mansion or cottage or whatever it was, house. And one day he must have been, you know, doing gardening work or whatever, and it certainly wasn't it was hardly even a minimum security situation. But he went into the house and he got dressed up in the lady of the house's attire. So he put on the dress and the cloak, and then he had a hat with a veil, and he took the parasol and he sashayed out past the guards and was never seen again.
Wow.
So he just disguised himself,
yeah.
And went out happy as you like.
You mentioned Darcy Dugan, and he's a name that a lot of people will be familiar with. But for our listeners, can you tell us who Darcy Dugan is and why is he so well known?
One of the things that I've noticed in common, having researched the couple of thousand escapees, is that you've got to have a certain amount of preparation done. You've got to have a friend on the outside or a few friends on the outside, and you've got to have the right escape gear. Now, the right escape gear is really only subject to each individual prisoner's imagination. So there was tricks like keeping a hacksaw in between the sole and the last of your shoe so that when you were in prison, you knew that you had that hacksaw in between the. I mean, that was a trick that lots of people tried and eventually was discovered. But Darcy Dugan, he'd racked up 100 charges when he was still a teenager, and he'd done multiple breakouts from boys' training centres. And, you know, boys' training centres are kind of like farms, really. And he boasted that no jail will hold me. But it has to be said that he was rather better at breaking out than staying out. So 1946, he cut his way out of a paddy wagon. So obviously prisoners have to go from jail to the courts in the city in a paddy wagon and then home again. Less these days, now that we're doing it all by video, but in those days there was a lot of transportation of prisoners. And a lot of them made their escape like that. So twice he cut his way out of a paddy wagon. There was one time when he had hidden about his person a sharpened fork, which he'd obviously got from the prison, and he used that to cut a hole in the ventilator of the paddy wagon while his fellow inmates, there were probably 10 of them in there, saying it's a long way to Tipperary to cover up the noise of him hacksawing with this little fork. So he dropped out onto the road, but he only lasted a couple of weeks on the outside. He didn't have the support. He had the urge to break out, Darcy, but he wasn't quite clever enough to actually get things in a position where he could stay out. So he was again jailed for robbery, and in 1949, he jumped from the Long Bay 6-metre wall before changing into ordinary clothes, not prison clothes, and strolling out the prison gates. So he changed into like visitor clothes or clothes that were left around, guard clothes, whatever. And again, that's another thing. A lot of people make clothes that look like the guards' uniforms in the prison workshop, or they'll make various items in the prison workshops, like pieces of leather from the boot shop can be used to make ropes. So it's really interesting how they, with a limited supply of things, they have to actually use their nous imagination and ingenuity to actually apply those to how they can get over that wall or get out through that window. So he lasted a week that time, and 1951, again, he was in Sydney Central Court. And he now, because they knew he was a runner, a bolter, he was always handcuffed. But he'd used wet bread. So he'd made bread soggy to make an impression of a key. Ooh. And then he used his belt buckle to make the key, and then used hacksaw blades, which he had hidden around his neck, to cut through the bar in the cell door. This is in the central court. So they're not quite as sturdy as some of the big jails are. So he had this hacksaw hidden down his chest, and you'd think that would have been the first thing they do. I mean, metal detectors they didn't have in those days, but you'd think they would have frisked them. And again, he'd ingeniously used the wet bread as a kind of mould to make the key for his handcuffs. So he went out that time with Bill Mears. And unfortunately, Bill Mears was a bit more trigger happy than Darcy. And they robbed a jockey and they robbed some banks, and Mears shot a bank manager. Mm. So because they were in the crime together, that was fairly serious for Darcy. Yeah. He was sentenced, they were both sentenced to death, but that was commuted. And this time Darcy was sent to Grafton, which was northern New South Wales, thought to be inescapable, and 2 to 3 to 4 more escape attempts, including he got the top of a bucket, a metal bucket, and was using that to gouge the plaster out of the walls in between the bricks. Oh, he went on a hunger strike, Emily. In 1953, he was part of a 12-man attempt to break out, so I hope you're counting all these, how many escapes.
I know, so many.
He got dobbed in, and then he got solitary confinement and what they call special treatment, which is kind of being beaten by the guards. Yeah. 1958, he was found patiently waiting in a small hole in the ground under a concrete floor for a chance to escape. So he never gave up.
Yeah.
He was released actually in 1967, but did seven more bank robberies. Jailed again in 1969, got 14 years. Released in 1980, again robbed a service station, jailed for 3.5 years. And he was released ultimately in 1985, age 65, so wow. He was retirement age, pensioner yeah. age, after 34 years in jail and 13 to 14 escape attempts.
He never gave up.
He never gave up, but he wasn't the cleverest of convicts. Yeah. So he never gave up. He just always wanted that chance at freedom, you know.
Yeah.
And, I mean, in a way you've got to – he goes down in history as probably the most frequent escape attempter.
After the break, Susanna tells us about some of the female convicts and escapees throughout Australian history.
While I've got you, can I also tell you that I'm doing a quick whip around the country for some live shows in the next few weeks, and I'd love to see you there. It's called Michelle Laurie, Bad Buddhist, which coincidentally is also the name of a new book that I have out that will be for sale there. Isn't that clever what I've done? Adelaide on October 20 at the Rhino Room, Melbourne October 27 at the Yarraville Club, Brisbane November 1 at the Paddo Tavern, Sydney November 3 at Giant Dwarf, and that's part of the Yak Festival. There's not going to be a lot of true crime, I'll be honest with you. There might be some. I don't know what there's going to be. It's going to be probably mostly that classic showbiz combination of Buddhism and comedy, you know, that classic combination, yeah. And also in Sydney at the Yak Festival, I will be bringing my favourite monk. He is in his 90s, he's Tibetan, he speaks no English, and he'll have his translator, who is a nun, and he's very hilarious, he's very brutal, to me mostly. So come to that, if you can. I'll put all the ticket buying details on our Facebook page, that's Australian True Crime on Facebook, and also on my Facebook page, Michelle Laurie, at Facebook. All right, now back to the show.
Coming up on Australian True Crime, Susanna tells us more about female escapees from Australian prisons.
So I wonder if, so we're talking about a lot of men, but what about women? Because there's been a few women who've tried to escape jail, hasn't there?
Yeah. There's actually, you know, it's interesting, having done 11 books on crime and particularly gang crime, but, you know, mainly violent crime for profit or drug dealing, whatever, we always have to sort of scrummage around trying to find the women, because you probably know, Emily, that, you know, something like 92% of crime is committed by men. And I sometimes think it's really not equal opportunity. Even the crimes that you think could be equally committed by women, like environmental crime or white-collar yeah. crime, it's still the vast majority of men. Yeah. And no one ever addresses that.
Yeah.
No one ever says, oh, people say, oh, well, the South Sudanese, they do more crime, you know, when they're young men than anyone else. But no one ever says, you know, 92% of crime, 98% of murders, and I think it's 98% of sex crimes and 96% of murders are committed by men. That might be reducing a little bit now.
Well, we always, often when we share, you know, we cover stories about violence against women, and we may share some cases. We do get, you know, the inevitable comments from some men going, well, what about women? And they highlight yeah. there's certainly some horrific crimes committed yeah. by women, but let's face it, there's more crimes committed by men. It's just yeah. a fact. But I remember reading saying that poisoning was often a crime that women favoured, yes. you know, back a long yeah. time ago.
Well, during the war, apparently women used to get rid of their husbands by using a bit of, you know, rat poison yeah. and
bit of rat sack in the tea.
Yeah, in the tea, yeah. But one of the highlights, I suppose, for our hunt for women escapees is Lizzie O'Brien, and she was the first and only woman to ever escape from Long Bay. Long Bay at that stage, back in the 1920s, had women and men in it. Now them are often separated. She was there one night and the next morning she was gone. And what they found was against the wall of Long Bay, and sometimes the walls were 3-4 metres high, she had stacked wheelbarrows, stools. She probably got them from the garden workshop or whatever. And she had made herself a little ladder to get over the top. Back in her cell, they found the lock part of the door wrapped in a cloth. So that's a bit of a mystery as to how she got out. But she got out. She stayed out for a couple of weeks. She was constantly a petty thief.
Yeah.
And so she got caught. She was staying with relatives, which is always a bad thing to do because the police and investigators who are hunting down escapees, they always go to your nearest and dearest to find out how you've managed to stay out. So she got caught in the usual way by clinging to the area that she knew and went back in, and then she got released, and then she tried to escape again. I think there was one attempt where she was rehabilitated a little bit, and so they let her work, sort of doing voluntary work for old people or whatever. They escaped from kind of low risk, sort of not maximum security prisons, the women. And in the end, Lizzie got done again for thieving. And she said to the magistrate, "You're old devil, I'll go get you. I'll get you." You know, she was so aggressive. Another woman who, oh gosh, she was in a way a victim of love. She was born in 1957. Her name was Julie Cashman. And they lived in Melbourne. The family lived in Melbourne to start off with. And her father, I think they lived in the Dandenongs, and her father had a trucking business where he used to deliver washing machines or something. And something tragic happened. A load of washing machines fell off the truck, you know, on one of those steep mountain roads, and it wasn't insured. And so the family really took a dive down the social ladder. So they moved up to Maroochydore, and she got involved with surfers and the fringe drug scene. So she's about my age. She's, you know, born around the time I was. And I remember that I got very keen on surfers and not necessarily the fringe drug scene, but there was always drugs and LSD around in that cohort. Then I think she was still a teenager. She moved to Sydney and a boyfriend, she did all these things for boyfriends, you know. A boyfriend got her to be a drug mule. It was the usual Bangkok, Australia run with, you know, Thai sticks, Buddha sticks, and which were very big in the 70s and 80s, I think. And unfortunately, no one told her that quite often the employers, the Mr. Bigs, and it's almost always the Mr. Bigs, quite often will sacrifice a mule in order to let a bigger batch of drugs go through on another flight. You know, they kind of say, "Well, okay, we'll give her this $100,000 batch of Thai sticks, but it's the heroin on the other flight that we're really worried about. Yeah, so we'll sacrifice her." So she got caught, and she was dobbed in. I mean, they were dobbed in, and she got 30 months with a minimum of 15. Went to Mwala first of all, and then she was moved to Cessnock. Now at Cessnock Jail, they had men and women separated by kind of double chicken wire. I mean, not chicken wire, but, you know, that sort of, you know, wire security fencing. Chicken wire would be a bit too – you could do it with your teeth probably. You could break it with your teeth. But she – there was a guy called Bob, and Bob was a lifer. Now, the thing about lifers is that they kind of have nothing to lose, you know, and it's often – it's often them that will help the people who have got 2 or 3 years get in touch with each other or might help a budding romance. So through Bob, she met across the wire barriers, you know, two lanes of wire barriers, she met a guy called Bruce Kennedy who was doing time for conspiracy to rob. And through Bob, who used to pass notes back and forth between the female section and that was a bit romantic, really.
Yeah, now because you think people would just probably text each other.
Yeah, except, well, mobile phones in prison.
That's right,
you know.
They're not meant to be allowed in prison,
So Bruce Kennedy and Julie fell in love, and he was waiting for her in November 1978, springtime, at the gates. He was waiting for her when she got out. They did a few supermarket robberies together, and invariably, you know, she was the one who took the load, who he would escape over rooftops and she'd be there arrested.
Yeah.
So she did ultimately get arrested. She was caught and she was back in jail now pregnant to Bruce Kennedy. So at the end of the year, Kennedy was on the outside of the jail and Julie was on the inside, and they'd arranged, probably through notes or visitor meetings or whatever, they'd arranged that there would be a breakout. And it's really interesting. What I've noticed is that there are a lot of breakouts around Christmas time or New Year. Mm. You know, Ronald Ryan. I mean, just lots and lots and lots. Sometimes it's because the warder's having a Christmas party.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's because the scheduling is a little bit different.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's one thing you notice when you study so many escapees is that you a lot around Christmas time. So it was the 28th of December and Kennedy was outside with his bolt cutters. He was cutting the perimeter fences and she climbed out, I think, through a high bathroom window, squeezed out, don't ask me how, given she was pregnant, or a skylight, and they managed to get away. So on the run. They were on the run, stealing as they went. They went up to Queensland. They weren't sure where to go. It was probably pretty exciting, bit of Bonnie and Clyde-ing, sort
yeah,
of, you might say.
Yeah, it does seem like that, doesn't it? In love, on the run.
Yeah, and pregnant.
Yeah.
So I don't think Bonnie ever got pregnant. But
no.
So they decided at one stage from Queensland to go to Perth. And so they went to say goodbye to some friends who were in Ashgrove, I think the suburb was. But when they got there, Kennedy dropped Julie to go in to see the house, and he was heading off to the shops probably to get some booze or something for a little get-together, a little party. But when they got there, the police were waiting. Julie was arrested and Kennedy smashed the car, did a runner because police were chasing him in the car as he was going off to the shops. And he was hit by a car, very, very badly injured. His spine was severed and he died the next year. He was put in an old person's home.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was awful. And he managed to meet his daughter, Jade, who was born in 1979, and then he died. So he's off the scene. Meanwhile, Cashman, Julie, and Jade, let me say for listeners who might be concerned about, you know, what kind of a life is this for a baby?
Yeah.
She was actually looked after by Julie Cashman's parents in Maroochydore. So, you know, I always thought, what happened to poor little Jade, you know? So then Julie's back in jail, gets out, and this time she stays with Neville Kennedy. When Bruce Kennedy died, there was a fellow inmate and robber called Ray Wright, and he did a whip around and organised the money to pay for Kennedy's funeral. So when Julie gets out again, she stays with Neville Kennedy, the brother of Bruce, and there she meets Ray Wright.
Yeah.
And she must have felt very grateful to him because he'd organised the funeral for her, for the father of her child. So 1982, Ray Wright and Julie do another Bonnie and Clyde round the country, stealing from supermarkets, stealing from RSLs. Mm. Again, you know, Bonnie and Clyde all over the place. They were nearly caught at one stage and Wright did a runner and Julie got caught and had to serve the time. And then she got bail. She jumped bail and they both went up to meet for a romantic reunion in Queensland. They were on the run for 2 years.
Wow.
On the run and thieving for 2 years.
But Jade wasn't with her, was
Jade
she?
Jade was safely with the parents. Yep. Yeah, I always like to think.
Yeah, no, I think, I hope there wasn't a little kid in the back seat.
In the baby seat while they were doing all these thievings. Sydney, 1983, they're on the run. They had this really big, lavish wedding. Very ostentatious and open for all to see while they're on the run at the Rocks in Sydney. Mm. And then Julie and her sister decide they'll go off and, you know, do some pubs or something afterwards, and the cab driver recognises her.
Oh, okay.
And she probably talked too much in the back of the cab as well. So Julie was in hospital. She went to jail, then she cut her hand deliberately and was in hospital, and she was broken out by two masked thugs. So, again, she's free. So this time she and Ray decide, you know, oh, look, we've got to get out of this life. Yep. You know, many, many prisoners and many escapees do.
Like ghosts going straight.
Going
isn't
straight,
it? Yeah.
But we've got to have first, we've got to have the last big job.
Yeah.
So they planned, this is for 1984, their last big job, which was going to be a payroll heist at the Walston Park Brisbane Hospital, a wages snatch.
So it'd be like a lot of cash.
It'd be like $200,000 or $300,000.
Yeah.
So they're all there. There's three guys, a guy called Lance who's the driver, and then Ray, and they get to the van that's got the money at the payroll, the armour guard van that had the payroll. Julie's dressed as a man. Someone else is in a gorilla uniform, costume, and they all had face masks.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because later nobody could believe that there was a woman in on the heist.
Oh, okay.
When it went to trial later. So anyway, they got the money. They're running with the bags of money toward their getaway car, shooting at the guards who are pursuing them. And the car is kind of revving and ready to go. And Julie jumps in the car, looks back, and there is Ray Wright dead on the ground with bags of money.
Oh, God, it's like a movie.
Yeah, it is like a movie. And so, I mean, I visualize all this in my mind, ex-actor, so
yeah,
I can't help visualizing,
Yeah.
And so there they are, you know, gorilla. They make a getaway. They realize he's dead.
And they've just got to leave him.
And they've just got to leave him there with the bags of money
and
get away. So they got some money in the car. So Ray's killed. Julie eventually gets 11 years with a 5.5-year minimum for that. She gets out. She does another in 1992. She gets involved with another guy and there's another bust. And, you know, so she's kind of mixed up in all these escapes, but she's not most well known for her escaping. She's most well known for her life of love and crime, you know. And she always maintained she loved those two blokes.
Yeah.
Even cops later said about her, she remained staunch. She always took the rap.
Yep.
If they jumped off the roof and ran away, she always took the rap.
This is a tough, really tough lady.
Woman, yeah. So 1991, she wrote a book called The Angel of Death because, again, you know, all these guys that got to know her ended up dead.
Yeah.
And, you know, she had a sad ending, Emily. She was frail. She was on welfare. She was living, you know, from hand to mouth.
Yeah.
And in 2003, she died aged 46. So
young.
A very unhappy life. But, you know, I mean, as you say, make a great movie, wouldn't it?
I know. I'm surprised. I know. I definitely have heard of her name just through, you know, the various research I've done. You know what it's like when you're searching one thing, you find another thing and you're like, I'll just put that in my little list for later. And you, there's just so many interesting stories.
And you do have to wonder about the psychology. You know, was it her first boyfriend that got her stoned and got her into weed and, you know, got her to do that initial Bangkok run?
Yeah.
I mean, another woman who wasn't an escapee herself but who helped a very experienced armed robber, John Killick, was Lucy Dudko.
Oh, yes, and, I've heard of this one.
This is also very dramatic and filmic. You know, a lot of this stuff I see it in film language. So Killick was a very experienced armed robber. He literally lost count of how many armed robberies he did, and he was jailed in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, in Goulburn, Bathurst, Pentridge, Yatala, Boggo Road and Silverwater. So he'd seen the inside of just about every jail. There were multiple escapes and escape attempts, usually with the help of besotted women. Now, I've seen pictures of him and he must have oozed charm because I didn't think he was such a catch, you know. But his most famous escape, and he had lots of others where, you know, he tried to escape from Pentridge and he wrote a book about it and he said, I didn't want to hurt the guard but I had to smash him on the head and the escape failed but the first thing I wanted to know was, is the guard okay? Mm. I hope I didn't kill him. So, again, there's mixed psychological things because constantly armed robbing and constantly in jail. But 1999 is in Silverwater, which is not known as the most, it's not Cat and Gill, it's not Gulb and Supermax, it's not, you know, the most maximum security. He had a girlfriend called Lucy Dudko, who was a Russian librarian who'd come over to Australia with her husband Alex. When she met Killick, she lost all interest in her husband and left him and was there visiting Killick and obviously plotting to escape in no uncertain terms. There was at that stage a film with Charles Bronson, which was about a Mexican escape using a helicopter inside the jail. And it was based on a real story about a guy that escaped from Mexican jail and managed to get back to America, and then they made a movie about it. So it may have been inspired, this this escape from Silverwater, by the film. So they planned their escape, Lucy and Killick. She hired a helicopter one day for a joyride near the Olympic site, which is not far away from Silverwater. Yeah. Now, she obviously had a gun, but I have no recollection that the pilot said, she stuck the gun in my mouth or in my face and told me to drive. It was all like, you know, she probably had the gun sitting on her lap. But on the 25th of March, which was the day before his court hearing, where he was going to work out whether he was going to get, you know, 10 years or whatever it was, at 10 a.m., Lucy took another helicopter with a different pilot for a ride, and it literally came down and hovered a few feet over the exercise yard. Now, where there's been attempts before with helicopters and planes and things, the problem is that all the prisoners try and jump on and hold on to the bottom of the helicopter, and it can't get away. But luckily, Killick climbed in, and before any of the other prisoners had a chance to jump on, the thing flew off. And they actually landed, and then they got a car, and they managed to stay out 45 days.
Yeah.
And then they were caught. So that was another really interesting involvement of a woman.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and five stars, and to follow us on Facebook.